All right, so get this. We're going to unpack a Supreme Court case that might, well, it might make you rethink everything you thought you knew about segregation in America. Ready for this? In 1873, decades before, you know, the infamous Plessy v. Ferguson, the highest court in the land, well, they actually struck down separate but equal.
It really is remarkable. You know, Railroad Covey Brown, it really pulls back the curtain on the just fierce legal battles over equal rights that were happening right after the Civil War. You know, during the Reconstruction era, it's a story about, you know, holding corporations accountable and really trying to figure out, you know, what lawmakers really intended. And it's about a woman named Catherine Brown who really stood up for her rights at a time when, you know, that took incredible courage.
Yeah. And you know, even if you're, you know, not a legal scholar or anything, I think this case is just absolutely riveting. It's about access and equality and how these seemingly small legal details can just, you know, snowball into these huge consequences. So picture this, right? It's 1868 and Catherine Brown, a black woman, is denied entry to the white lady's car on a train. You know, seems pretty straightforward, right? Well, hold on, because here's where it gets a little interesting. Her ticket was issued by the original railroad company. But the line was being leased to another company at the time.
Right.
And this little detail, well, it becomes a key piece of this legal puzzle later on.
Yeah, that's right. And to understand why that even matters, you know, we have to kind of rewind back to 1863 when Congress granted the Alexandria and Washington Railroad Company permission to extend their line. But there was a condition, a clause in their charter specifically prohibited them from excluding, you know, anybody based on their color.
Ah, so that's where the conflict comes in.
Exactly.
So the railroad company, when they were faced with this lawsuit, they threw out a defense that, well, it's going to sound eerily familiar to anyone who knows their legal history.
Yeah.
Separate but equal facilities.
Mm.
They claimed that providing separate accommodations for black and white passengers meant that, well, that they were in compliance with the law.
Right.
Talk about, like, you know, a blast from the past.
Yeah, it really does set the stage for a journey, you know, a legal journey that goes all the way to the Supreme Court. So it starts in district court, and Catherine Brown actually, she wins.
Oh.
But the railroad company, they weren't content with that outcome, so they decided to appeal it. They took the case all the way to the top.
So now, they didn't just appeal on the core issue of, you know, of segregation, right? They got a little creative. They tried to, like, sidestep the whole lawsuit by challenging the technicalities of, you know, the legal process itself.
That's right. The railroad company tried, they tried two main tactics to try to avoid, you know, responsibility here. First, they questioned whether the lawsuit was properly served, you know, hoping to get the whole thing thrown out just based on a technicality.
Oh, so it's like they were saying you didn't follow the exact procedure, so we're off the hook.
Exactly.
Clever. But did it work?
Not a chance. The Supreme Court saw right through it. They essentially said, look, serving a director of the company is good enough, right? That's sufficient to hold the whole corporation accountable. There's no escaping justice on a technicality here.
Okay. So procedural challenge number one, fail. What about tactic number two? Did they also try to shift the blame to the lessees, the ones who were actually operating the line at the time?
Yeah, they did. And this is really where, you know, the case, it gets really fascinating because the court was incredibly clear. You can't just hand over operations and just wash your hands of your obligations. In fact, you know, the majority opinion stated very clearly, and I quote, a railroad company cannot escape duties by surrendering its road into the hands of lessees.
Oh, okay, that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah.
It sounds like this case goes, you know, way beyond just this one railroad company. It's like they established a blueprint for holding corporations accountable, you know, even today.
You're absolutely right. This case touches on, you know, the very core of corporate law. It establishes that delegating operations doesn't, you know, it doesn't erase the obligations, you know, that are enshrined in that original charter.
Right.
You know, this has huge implications for how we think about corporate social responsibility, even in the 21st century.
Hold on, because my mind is blown right now. So even back in 1873, they were wrestling with these issues of corporate responsibility. This is getting more and more relevant by the minute.
Absolutely. But before we, you know, before we get too carried away, remember, we haven't even gotten to the main event.
Right.
You know, the court's ruling on segregation itself.
Oh, you're right. Okay, okay. Let's get down to brass tacks. Lay it on me. What happened when the Supreme Court finally tackled the question of separate but equal?
Well, on the issue of, whether the railroad's separate but equal policy was actually legal under their, congressional charter, the court's answer was a resounding no.
I knew it, but I have to ask, how did they justify that decision? I mean, did they just disagree with separate but equal, or was there something, something more to it?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting. You see, the court, they didn't just disagree with, the railroad company's segregation policy. They called it an ingenious evasion of Congress's intent.
Ingenious evasion, huh?
Yeah.
Sounds like they were calling the railroad out on trying to play like a sneaky legal game. What was it about their actions that get such a sharp rebuke from the court?
Well, the court, they zeroed in on what Congress, what they really intended when they wrote that charter way back in 1863. They recognized that Congress wasn't just trying to make sure that, black passengers could like physically get on the train.
Right.
They wanted to ensure equality in the use of the train cars themselves.
So it wasn't just about like access to the train. It was about being treated equally once you were on board. That
Exactly.
makes a lot of sense.
To really grasp the weight of this, we need to look at the words of Justice Davis, who wrote the majority opinion. He stated, and I quote, "Discrimination in the use of the cars was the subject of discussion, when Congress drafted the charter. This makes it crystal clear that Congress, they were aiming to eliminate any kind of hierarchy or differential treatment based on race. In their eyes, separate was inherently unequal."
That's a powerful statement. It really highlights that true equality goes beyond just, physical presence. It's about ensuring that everyone has the same rights and privileges. But this raises a big question that's been bugging me. If the Supreme Court was so clear on this in 1873, how did it take until, the Civil Rights Act in 1964 to address these issues on a larger scale? And how on earth did Plessy v. Ferguson manage to like uphold separate but equal later on? I mean, it seems like a total contradiction.
You're hitting on a really, really crucial point here. The answer lies in the difference between, statutory interpretation and constitutional interpretation.
Right.
Brown was decided based on the interpretation of a specific law, in this case, the railroad company's congressional charter. Plessy, on the other hand, was a challenge based on the 14th Amendment of the US Constitution.
Okay, so I'm starting to see the distinction here. So in Brown, the court was focused on what Congress meant when they wrote that charter, right?
Yeah.
No exclusion from the cars based on color. But in Plessy, they were grappling with whether the 14th Amendment, which, guarantees equal protection under the law, allowed for separate but equal facilities.
Precisely. And because Brown was based on interpreting a specific law, it didn't create this broad rule that could automatically be applied to cases that were dealing with the Constitution.
Right.
This means that Brown, while it was a significant moral victory, it had a limited impact in terms of, setting a legal precedent.
So even though the court rejected separate but equal in Brown, it wasn't like a knockout blow, right? The fight against segregation, I mean, it had a long way to go.
Yeah.
That's both fascinating and frustrating, to be honest.
It is,
Yeah.
but we shouldn't downplay the significance of Brown. It clearly articulated the flaws in separate but equal logic. Flaws that would be further exposed during, the civil rights movement decades
Oh,
later.
right.
It showed that even when the odds seemed, stacked against them, legal challenges to discrimination, they could succeed.
It's like a glimmer of hope in this long and difficult journey,
Yeah.
a testament to the power of persistence and the unwavering belief in justice.
Exactly. And it reminds us that legal battles are often fought on multiple fronts. Sometimes a strategic win in a specific case can lay the groundwork for broader social change, even if that change takes time.
Speaking of strategic wins, let's shift gears for a moment and talk about, the lessons Brown offers to, to legal practitioners today. I'm particularly struck by how the court just shut down the railroad's attempts to just dodge responsibility.
Right.
What can lawyers learn from this aspect of the case?
Oh, there's a lot to unpack there. The court's rejection of, the railroad's attempt to shift blame onto the lessees, it offers this crucial lesson about corporate liability. It firmly establishes that parent companies can't just shield themselves from their obligations by, by delegating operations to other entities.
So it's a warning to anyone leasing or contracting. You can't hide behind, you know, corporate structures to escape accountability.
Precisely. This principle has major implications for modern corporate law, especially when you look at things like environmental protection, labor standards, and of course, you know, civil rights.
It also speaks to, you know, the growing emphasis on corporate social responsibility.
Right.
You know, yeah. Companies can't just turn a blind eye to what their subsidiaries or contractors are doing. They have a responsibility to ensure that all of their operations, you know, regardless of who's carrying them out, are conducted ethically and in accordance with the law.
Absolutely. And this ties into another key takeaway from Brown, the importance of legislative intent.
Right.
You know, remember how the court called out the railroad segregation policy as an ingenious evasion of what Congress really intended?
Yeah, that was a pretty memorable moment. It was like, yeah, the court was saying, you know, nice try, but we see right through your, you know, fancy legal footwork. You can't just twist the law to fit your own, mm-hmm, you know, discriminatory agenda.
Exactly. Brown teaches us that courts won't tolerate, you know, attempts to circumvent the true spirit of the law through clever legal maneuvering.
Yeah.
The focus should always be on upholding the intended purpose of legislation, especially when it comes to protecting fundamental rights.
That's such an important lesson, especially today when we're, you know, we're constantly grappling with new legal challenges and rapid technological advancements.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds us that the law is this living, breathing thing, and its interpretation should always be guided by, you know, its underlying principles and goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Couldn't have said it better myself. And it's this kind of, you know, nuanced legal thinking that makes Brown such a rewarding case to study. It's not, yeah, it's not just a historical relic. It's a source of, you know, timeless legal wisdom.
It's like a legal time capsule.
Yeah.
Offering, you know, insights that are just as relevant in the 21st century as they were back, mm-hmm, in 1873.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of timeless insights, I keep thinking about, you know, the broader implications of this case for the fight against discrimination as a whole.
Mm.
If the Supreme Court could recognize, you know, the inherent inequality of separate but equal back then, why did it take so long for this principle to become truly embedded in our laws and in our society?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Right.
It's one we could spend, you know, hours, even days dissecting. But for now, let's just acknowledge that legal progress is rarely a straight line. It's,
yeah,
often a long and winding road filled with both setbacks and victories.
Yeah.
You know, steps forward and steps back.
So Brown, despite its limited scope, represents a significant milestone on that long road to justice.
Absolutely. It's a testament to the courage of individuals like Catherine Brown, who dared to challenge the status quo and demand, you know, equality under the law. And it reminds us that even seemingly small legal victories can have this ripple effect,
yeah,
inspiring others to join the fight and creating momentum for lasting change.
What a powerful and inspiring message.
Yeah.
And what a fascinating deep dive this has been so far. You know, before we wrap things up, there's one final question that's been like swirling around in my mind. You've mentioned corporate responsibility and legislative intent, but,
yeah,
but what about individual responsibility? Where do we as individuals, you know, fit into all of this?
That's a fantastic question. And it's one that each of us needs to really grapple with. After all, you know, the law is only as good as the people who uphold it and the society that embraces it.
So how do we as individuals ensure that we're not perpetuating, you know, discrimination, even unintentionally? How do we become active participants in the fight for equality rather than, you know, passive bystanders?
Well, you know, Brown reminds us that justice requires, you know, vigilance, mm-hmm, courage, and a willingness to challenge injustice wherever we see it. It's a call to action, not just for lawyers and judges, but for each and every one of us.
So what specifically can we do besides, obviously, you know, not discriminating against others? Are there steps we can take in our everyday lives to promote equality and challenge injustice?
Absolutely. It starts with awareness, educating ourselves about the history of discrimination and the ways it still manifests in our society today.
Right. Like understanding the subtle forms of bias that can creep into our decision making, or the systemic inequalities that continue to, you know, disadvantage certain groups.
Exactly. Once we have that awareness, then we can start to, you know, to challenge those biases and advocate for change.
So speaking up when we see injustice happening, calling out discriminatory language or behavior, mm-hmm, and supporting organizations that are working to dismantle systemic barriers.
Yes. And it's also about you know, using our voices and our votes to support policies that promote equality and opportunity for all.
It's about being allies to those who are marginalized and using our privilege to amplify their voices.
Precisely. It's about recognizing that the fight for equality is an ongoing process and that we all have a part to play.
This has been such an eye-opening conversation. Railroad Kobe v. Brown may seem like this distant historical event, but it's clear that its lessons are still relevant today.
It's a reminder that progress is possible, but it requires constant effort and vigilance.
So let's all commit to doing our part to challenge discrimination and promote equality in our own lives and in our communities.
And let's continue to learn from the past as we work together to create a more just and equitable future.
This deep dive has been a powerful reminder of that. Thanks for joining us, and as always, keep diving deep.